Utopia.
Tektopia er en ugentlig podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, støttet af .dk, IDA Forsikring og Messecenter Herning. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Danmark var i 2017 det første land i verden, som oprettede en post som tech-ambassadør. Og det primære formål var jo at sparke døren ind hos de amerikanske tech-giganter for at skabe en dialog med de her virksomheder, der både i økonomisk størrelse og indflydelse er vokset til noget, som kan minde om nationalstater. Året efter, i 2018, fulgte Frankrig trop med verdens anden tech-ambassadør. Han hedder Henri Verdier, og i den forgangne uge der var han på besøg her i Danmark, hvor jeg fik en samtale med ham på den franske ambassade foran sådan et lille eksklusivt publikum. Vi skulle tale om hans bog The Business of Hate. Det handler om sociale medieplatformes skadelige indflydelse på vores kultur og vores børn og den offentlige debat, og så handler det også om mis- og desinformation. Men allerførst, inden vi gik i gang med at høre om hans bog, så skulle jeg lige høre, hvad hans mission som tech-ambassadør egentlig er, fordi den er nemlig lidt anderledes end den danske tech-ambassadørs.
Denmark started maybe in 2016 with a tech envoy. So you thought, and it was very interesting, that there is a need to confront and to exchange the big tech companies because they are new powers in these times. For France, it was an heresy because we don't agree to treat those companies like nation states and sovereign states. So that was first an answer, a reaction. We did appoint an ambassador for digital affairs. That's not an ambassador to negotiate with the companies. That's an ambassador for regulation, for global environment, multi-stakeholder forum, multilateral forum. But from the beginning, as you said, we started an intense conversation between the two countries because we were the only one ambassadors in charge of the stuff. Maybe I start. I tell you that I'm a veteran in the tech field. I started my first internet company in 1995. In France, there were 50,000 web surfers, and I did start a company. So it was before Facebook, before Google, before Amazon. So maybe I'm not such a great entrepreneur, I don't know, because I'm not as rich as those guys. But today, and that's my answer, this is pure geopolitics. Today, the global international order is shaped by a lot of aspects of the digital revolution. There is a race to the top, for example, to be the first to control AI. There are confrontations about access to some fundamental resources, materials, or there is a global fight for values. So there is a new order that is very confrontational, with a kind of fragmentation of the world. And of course, it does happen also in the cyberspace. The cyber warfare is a reality. We can see it in Ukraine. But the confrontation of model and values is even worse. And so we try to exchange in the United Nations system. But everyone comes with his values, his systems. So basically, the job of an ambassador for digital affairs is to try to unify a coherent digital international posture, external action. And I won't enumerate because it starts with cybersecurity. It does continue with disinformation. But it can lead us to ethics of AI, passing through regulation of big tech companies. Usually we do it within a European framework because that's the only way to be strong enough. But also the economic development policies. If we give money to countries to build their infrastructure within some foreign platforms, we don't empower them, we enslave them. So we have to help them also to seize all the opportunities of the digital revolution. To conclude, let's think just about one thing. France, as you can imagine, stands for cultural and linguistic diversity, and we are very attached to French and Francophonie. But what's the purpose to finance, to stand for Francophonie, if the AI don't speak French? If they are, and I don't say speaking French, if they are not trained with French point of view. And that's true for French, but also for Danish or every languages and every culture. So for example, when we think about Francophonie, we have to think about how to be sure that we will accede freely to AI that were trained with French resources. So it can, that's changing every aspect of diplomacy. So my job is to lead the transformation of the global diplomacy to face the consequences of the digital revolution.
Henri Verdiers mandat som tech-ambassadør ligner måske mere en ministerpost. Et sted mellem teknologi, innovation, handel, kultur og EU-regulering af sådan ting som konkurrenceregler, forbrugerbeskyttelse og etik. Han er simpelthen til stede der, hvor der er tech med i ligningen. Hans bog, ja, den er så til gengæld fokuseret på den digitale manipulation af den offentlige debat. Så lad os starte med et eksempel. Den enorme mængde af vækkelus på hoteller i Paris.
Yes, that's a good example. Maybe you have seen the controversy regarding the invasion of bed bugs in Paris. Did you? No? A lot of people did, and for example, did consider not to come to the Olympic Games. As a Parisian citizen, I'm not... okay, that's okay for me, because... but okay, that's another question. And so basically, so first I could say that bed bugs are all coming from New York. Can I say that? No, we have, but not more than Denmark or Germany or other countries. The controversy was really amplified by Russian intelligence services. And here, all intelligence services did share evidences publicly to prove that a network of bots and et cetera were mobilized. But we had to face, we have quite every week something like this. After the October 7 attack from the Hamas to Israel, some people did paint Magen David, I don't know how you name the Israeli star, and then there were big controversies, and the guys that did make the painting were paid by Russia. We did catch them. And that's important because this is not just about lies. And sometimes they don't lie. They all, on the contrary, they share something that is true, but they do emphasis on or sometimes they hid, they mask some reality. So the problem is not the problem of fake news, the problem is the problem of dissensus, polarization. After the Trump election, there were the Mueller investigation. Do you remember this? So there were a big investigation. And for example, the Mueller report proves that the Russian services did come into Wikipedia web pages, for example, pro-life or pro-choice, but just to yell, not to change the content, but to change the nature of the conversation, to be more aggressive and more polarizing. And so that's really something we have to recognize, to know, and to prepare ourselves to face, because that's just the beginning.
Ifølge Verdier, så handler misinformation om at skabe kaos og splittelse i vores samfund, at spille borgerne ud mod hinanden. I sin bog, der trækker han en linje fra internettets fødsel som et forum for ubetinget ytringsfrihed til i dag, hvor det sådan er en samling af filterbobler, der er fora for fiktive data og algoritmer, som ikke rigtig giver os nogen vigtig information eller faktuel viden, og som ikke rigtig har betydning for os, men kun spilder vores tid og polariserer vores borgere og vores forskellige holdninger, i stedet for at skabe en sund demokratisk debat, hvor vi møder andre folks synspunkter med argumenter baseret på fakta, i stedet for at vi bliver manipuleret ind i kaninhuller af algoritmer.
I really think that there is a threat on democracy itself for a lot of reasons. And that we have to face a political issue. That's not an economic issue nor a technological issue. It started So the main problem concern from my perspective are the social network, or maybe we should say the social media. We are living in a world where we have a lot of misinformation, so the spread of conspirationism, for example, is impressive. A lot of polarization, a lot of violence, a lot of disinformation, so I say misinformation when people are just crazy, and disinformation when there is an organized, determined campaign coming from a foreign country. And here, just to mention it, maybe we'll come back to it. I don't know if everyone realizes that we have to face very professional, very organized, financed, and numerous people that know what they do. And they take a lot of lessons from a century of history of disinformation, where, for example, the CIA was great too, or bad, you decide, but very professional too. But they do it at a time where maybe we don't do it anymore, and that's great, and where social network gives them a lot of much more power. But we have to face people very organized. We also have to face terrorist content, the spread of terrorist content, the spread of pornographic content, and pedocriminality, and at the center of this are the social networks. That's one observation. The second one is that when I say that there is a threat on democracy itself, maybe we have to think again about what is democracy. From my perspective, to be a real democracy, you need at least three things. So the first is freedom of speech, of course. And there is a kind of freedom of speech in the social network. Even if we can contest a bit, I will come back to it. The second one is free election. But there is something that people tend to forget. There is a need of real controversy. Democracy is a system where people confront themselves, confront opinions, exchange, contest, yell, fight. But then there is a collective decision, and then we all agree to respect the collective decision. And one of the main concerns of the world where we did enter in is that we are more and more locked in small worlds. And I can share with you an experience. 4 years ago, I did visit the headquarters of the Bloomberg campaign in New York. And a friend of mine was a great data scientist, and he did lead the data strategy of the Bloomberg campaign. So he did take me in a room, and he told me, look, here I have 54 tables. So one for each state, and plus one for the black people, one for the Latino people, one for the gay people, and one for, I don't remember. And every day they had spin doctors that did prepare a different message for each community. And every day they did spread with personal advertising messages to the different communities. So I told him, but that's awful, because that's not a collective conversation. That's a battle of personal advertising. And that's not one people, one vote, that's $1, one vote. So he didn't understand me. But that was the Bloomberg campaign. But if you read some articles, the Trump campaign, it was 50,000 micro world. They were much more precise. And I did ask to my American friends, but where is a nation deciding collectively a common future? If a campaign now is 50,000 very, very small worlds with very specific messages, and your adversary doesn't know what you pretend to all those small groups and cannot answer, and there is not any more public confrontation. That's a battle of advertising, of hidden advertising. So, and this is a model where we did enter. A model of, micro messages, and not anymore, and we did exchange about this a bit earlier. We don't know where is the center, where is the common knowledge, where is the institution, where is the... So that's a very first big concern. The second one is that I did mention advertising. So those social media, they became the new public space. maybe not you and me, but our children, they are living in this space. That's where they learn, where they meet, where they organize themselves. And this so-called public space, or quiet public space, is not neutral, is not democratic. There is a huge design of this. I don't know if you know, but when you are in a social network, every people you meet, every information you see, every advertising you receive are decided by algorithms. You just see 50% of what your friends write. And those 50% are decided by algorithms. And with just one purpose, the attention economy. They want to catch your brain and to make you focus and to make you addict. So at some point, it does twist everything because you don't receive the most important information, nor the most true information, not even the information that matters for you. You receive the information that will make you addict. So, and of course, that's automatic. Mr. Zuckerberg or Mr. They didn't decide to give you, can I say shit? To give you the most ugly aspect of what you can imagine. They just decide to give you what will make you come back tomorrow, again and again and again. Let's imagine, most of us are parents. If we decide to give to our children the food they did prefer last week, after 1 month they will eat, so in France, fries and Coca-Cola and ice cream, and they will never eat vegetables. So Facebook and the others, they act like very bad parents. They just give you more of what you did like yesterday, and more and more and more. And there are a lot of very precise consequences. Because, and you did mention one, or you did, the filter bubble. So after a few interactions, you just receive the information that you agree with. That's why today, I'm speaking to you, 40% of the American citizens really believe that Trump won last election. 40% of the voters today. Because they just meet people thinking alike, and they just receive messages pretending the same, etc. There are other consequences, like what we call the echo chamber. So someone says something stupid somewhere, and I receive this through 10 channels, and I have the feeling that everyone is saying the same, and there is just one source, but coming diffracted from everywhere. Let's prepare for a world where there will be much more capacity to do this. And those companies, because of this design that depend of this business model, they are very hackable. That's very easy to spread disinformation or to isolate people or to spread polarization or controversy or radicalization. So they are a weakness for us.
Men hvis Vadim virkelig mener, at demokratiet er truet af misinformation og filterbobler på sociale medieplatforme, hvad kommer der så til at ske her i år, når 4 milliarder mennesker går til valg, blandt andet i Indien, EU og USA?
Ja, yeah, så so there are, if I'm correct, 4 billion people will change their will vote this year. So everyone is a bit nervous. And to be frank, I think that we are more or less, but we are a bit prepared until the deepfake until the new AI controversies. Did you see Sora, for example, the last OpenAI? So now you can make a very, very great 3 minutes video with just a prompt. So now we are trying to urge a response to deepfake. That's the new, the real current today issue. For example, if you do observe what did happen in the US, there is no evidence that those approaches can literally change the result of an election. It doesn't make a lot of people to change their mind. The problem is more about polarization. I don't know if you do remember, but 20 years ago in the US, they had a lot of bilateral agreements or law, and they don't have any more. And there is a radicalization. So this is a long-term efficiency. I don't know if you really can completely change the result of an election. And we have a lot of examples where, on the contrary, it was counterproductive. It doesn't always come from a country, and it doesn't always. That's not always about elections. I had a long exchange with my Irish counterpart. They had a referendum regarding abortion 5 years ago, and they were an intense campaign, but from extreme religious people from the US. And they did carpet bombs the conversation. And it did produce the contrary, because the feeling that a foreign religion was trying to change, and of course they were Protestants in a Catholic country, so it did produce quite the contrary. So that's the main risk for me, is to fragmentize, to polarize the opinion, to make people more cynical, more nihilist, to make people to weaken institutions and the press. That's not so easy to completely change one election.
Nu er det jo nemt nok at male fanden på væggen. Noget andet er, at det skal op med en løsning på hele den her misere. Hvad Jim mener, at det bliver et langt sejt træk baseret på den lovgivning, som EU allerede har vedtaget de senere år, altså GDPR, Digital Service Act, kendt som DSA, og Digital Market Act, kendt som DMA, og så AI-akten, altså hele den her lovgivning omkring kunstig intelligens.
So the question now, and to conclude and to launch the exchange, is what can we do? And I don't have there is no silver bullet, and I don't have one idea that will change everything. But first, Europe, we did well for the first the last three years, I think. First, we did recognize that there is a need for regulation. That was not so obvious. In 2000, we did adopt the first e-commerce directive, and we did consider those companies are just technical infrastructure, neutral, and we said they are media and they are technical companies. Media are responsible, they have a framework. Technical companies, they just have to comply with law enforcement, and they are not responsible of the content. So during the last 10 years, we did recognize that there is a third status. There are companies that, yes, they are not publisher nor media, but they curate, they promote, they select, they spread the content, so they have a kind of responsibility. And then we did conceive the famous Digital Service Act, so which is very important, because we are trying, we'll see it works or not, I don't know. I have good expectation, but we don't know. We need to test it. But the idea was not to control the media, the social media, not to tell as government where is the truth. It was to make them accountable. Basically, the heart of the Digital Service Act is that every country will have an independent authority, and they will have every year to present a serious risk analysis to those companies. And if they are not serious, they can face huge consequences. A fine of 4% of the world revenue. So they will. So and that's a constantly improving system. So the first year, if they make a non-serious risk analysis, we can say, be careful. Next year, you do better, or you have to face. You will receive a big fine. So risk analysis at the beginning of the year and action plan at the end of the year. How to correct, to mitigate the risks. And every year, again and again and again. And if you look carefully, that's what we did for the banking system, for example. We didn't start with BAL 2 30 years ago. We started with very simple rules, and then we did elaborate in a kind of co-conception. Slightly confrontational, but slightly cooperational too. So we did exchange seriously with the companies. And within this confrontation, we did conceive a better and better and better regulation framework. So that's the DSA. It was adopted last year, so we need a bit time to implement it. So my personal belief is that that's very important. That's what we have to do today, but that it won't be enough. And we did exchange earlier. I did recall that during 40 years in the US, they had a beautiful regulation that was named the Fairness Doctrine. So it was established in 1948, if I'm correct, and Reagan did delete it in 1983. The Fairness Doctrine was the idea that there were a duty for every media to to present every aspect of a confrontation. Not to give one heart to one and one heart to the other, no, just to explain that there were point of views, there were different positions in a controversy. One media in 1969 did go to the Supreme Court to contest the Fairness Doctrine on behalf of the First Amendment. Because I don't know if you know, but the US, they give the protection of the Constitution to citizens and companies in the same bucket. So he said, I'm a company, I have the free speech right, I can tell whatever I want. And the Supreme Court decided in a beautiful decision that in a real democracy, the right of the citizen to accede to a good information was higher than the right of a company to say whatever they want. Because they say the First Amendment is there to protect the democracy, but the democracy starts with good information, not with free speech. That was a very beautiful decision. But then they did delay, suspend this bill, this law, and in 1983, and in 1984 was born Fox News, and then the beginning of the story that led to Trump election. That's fascinating. So I deeply believe that we need more engagement, more research, more conversation with the companies, and that at the end of the day, we'll need to conceive a fairness doctrine for algorithms. We can say to those companies, okay, maybe 80% of the content you will present to the people will be to serve your business model, but 20% has to be to give them a broader view, to confront them to other point of view, to meet people that they did never meet, because we want to continue as a nation with a kind of unity. So we cannot be fragmentized like this. If you do observe the history of media, we did always conceive a framework to regulate the media. And it was to protect the media. For example, you cannot be attacked in justice if you're a journalist. But they have higher rights and higher responsibilities. But they were always a specific status for media. To use really seriously the DSA, to think about how to regulate the algorithms themselves. But this is not enough to protect ourselves from the foreign attacks regarding disinformation. Again, I want to share with you that's very important. Those attacks are not just to make us believe fake news. That's the most simple and obvious aspect of those attacks. To make it simple, they don't try to make you believe fake news. They want you to believe nothing. They want to spread chaos, nihilism. And they are very efficient for this. So we have to prepare ourselves. So here, basically, we can make two things. First, as authorities, as public service, we can contribute to detect and dismantle some networks of bots, fake accounts, etc. And we do. And we don't delay ourselves. We show them to the companies and we say, look, this is violating your terms of services. Make your decision. You are a free company. But I prove you that those people are not people. They are bots. Or AI, or whatever you want. And probably there will be also a need of much better education. And here I'm not speaking about education to media, to be a good consumer of media. You need a level of awareness, of commitment, of engagement of the new citizen that was never approached. I think that I have seen a beautiful, I don't exactly know how you do organize this in Denmark. In Finland, they have a beautiful program because you don't have just a small lesson about media awareness. The teacher of mathematics have a lesson about how to lie with statistics. The teacher of art show you that if you change the framework of a picture, you change the sense and the story of the picture. The framework of the teacher of history explain to you why was the rhetoric of fascism so efficient. So every teacher tried to make a much more aware citizen.
Vatier, han er altså ikke nervøs for, at enkeltstående valg sådan forandrer alting lige på én gang. Det handler mere om det lange, seje træk, som vi skal arbejde imod. Vi skal arbejde for at mindske indflydelsen fra tech-giganternes platforme, så vi kan forhindre, at der bliver spredt alt for meget misinformation. Og samtidig skal vi fremme innovation. Vi skal fremme transparens i teknologi og forretningsmodeller, så vi kan forstå, hvad der foregår. Og så skal vi blive bedre til at bruge open source som et fælles gode. Vi skal hylde konkurrence, frihandel, ytringsfrihed, privatliv, datasikkerhed, alt sammen sådan nogle gode, liberale EU-værdier. Og så var der lige de der tanker om fairness, som han havde hentet i USA. Hvordan har han egentlig tænkt sig, at de skal spille ud i en verden med sociale medier?
So today, as I told you, in Europe, we did work hard to find a new status to those kind of companies, and we have this. First, it was in the directive against terrorist content (TCO) 4 years ago, and then we did use it for the DSA and for the DMA. So we named them gatekeeper because they control the access to the information, and we did create some responsibilities for companies that does curate the content, promote the content, select, editorialize the content. And that was important. Then we did adopt the DSA during the French presidency of EU, but it was implemented just 6 months ago, and we are still building some pieces of the DSA. I think that it's time to give a chance to this framework and to the DSA. I just bet that we'll have to go further. But that's not so difficult. For example, in the DSA, and that was a French proposition, we did require a free access for researchers to the data and the algorithms. So now we have people that can show the algorithm and see how they work. So now, if we decide that the algorithm have to give, we can make it very simple. 20% of the recommendations should be aleatory. That's not so difficult to decide nor to check. But that's not the time of this conversation because we did just adopt a very strong regulation and we have to go as far as possible with the current regulation.
So maybe
and
we
I need some personal ideas to sell more books.
Okay, we can develop some ideas. But you mentioned early in your talk the importance of having a generative AI in your national language. And I guess that also goes for sort of like carrying your culture into the future.
Yeah.
You do have an important generative AI company in France called Mistral.
Let's start with not a joke, but a funny observation. If you ask to, you can make the experience. Ask to ChatGPT, who did invent aviation? And ChatGPT will answer, the brother Wright, you know, because that's the first flight, a 20-meter flight, but a flight. Ask the same question to Mistral AI, they will say Clément Adler. Clément Adler was the first engineer to make a patent with the word aviation. And of course, they are not patriotic. But if you teach a model with the Library of Congress, they speak about the brother Wright. If you have access to the national French patent system, they know what is the most ancient patent, what is the first patent. So that's a good example, no? If you don't feed the models with your culture, and yet that's also about culture. When I was young, I did learn a bit about linguistics, you know, and I've learned, maybe you know better than me, than in Inuit. Do you say Inuit? I don't know if that's true, but my teacher told me that they have the same word for blue and green. That's one word. And that they have 15 words to different kinds of white. That's probably true. But if you pass through one language that does erase all the subtlety of your language, you lose a lot of information, a lot of subtlety. So that's another, because I have a lot of concerns with this. One is if we all have to live with one point of view, and I told you earlier, you know, there is a famous hypothetical problem with AI. If you have a self-driving car, at some point, for example, one day it will happen that, I don't know, one grandmother will cross the street and the car knows that the children in the back seat is not doesn't have the safety belt. So the car will decide if you kill the grandmother of the child. Now, if you make a poll in Europe, 70 or 75% of Europeans say, let's save the baby. If you make the same question in Japan, 70% of Japanese will say, let's save the grandmother. Because you are two different cultures. So if we have to live in one ethical rule, that is one AI, we lose everything. We lose our culture, our autonomy, our ethics, and our freedom, because we have to respect one rule. That's one concern. The other one is if there is a global organization of the world with one central language. And here we come back to my example of blue and green in one word. And if we pass through English to translate everything, you lose information every time. Personally, I make I like to. Do you know DeepL? DeepL is a German. So we diplomats, we know DeepL very well because that's the best translation tool. And that's German. I recognize that sometimes the best tools are not French. So very often I play with DeepL. If you say le docteur et l'infirmier sont contents, translate in Spanish, you will say it will become el médico y la enfermera. So I did mention a male, it become a woman. Because it passes through the nurse. So you lose the gender when you pass through English. Or I say, j'étais très content de te voir, Christophe. And it becomes, ich war froh, sie zu sehen. Because you don't know if this is tu or vous. So every time you will have one central language, you lose subtlety, information. So that's why France, we do encourage a lot Europe to finance translation tool from every European language to every other European language. Direct translation from Danish to Italian, from German to Swedish. And we are succeeding. So there will be they name it an edict. That's a way to finance research. For translation tool, that is a form of AI, from every European language to every European language. That's a budget of 300 million euros, and the Commission will pay half of the money, and that's very, very important.
But do we actually have the investment that we need to create this environment in Europe? For if you look at OpenAI, they received $10 billion from Microsoft, yeah. But Mistral has received
$500 million. That's a great question, but I think that yes. Because, of course, the big tech companies, they tell us, yes, you need $10 billion a year, that's very expensive, you don't realize, don't even try. When I speak with the most serious people, like Yann Lequin, the head of AI for Facebook, that's funny because a lot of those guys are French, so I have direct access to. Now, for example, I can recognize that most of the big tech companies' CEOs are Indian. Let's respect this, that's true. But the head of AI research are mostly French, so I exchange with them constantly. They tell me that first, the price of a copy of the web is decreasing very fast. Now, with 20 million, you can buy a copy of the web. And next year it will be 10 million. And then that to train the model, that's not so expensive. Maybe 100 million euro. The cost of OpenAI is because they do allow every stupid citizen to make stupid questions and stupid jokes. So the cost of the run is very, very expensive. And because they don't have a business model, they have to pay all the cost of the run. But to make a model and to use it carefully in a dedicated use, that's not so expensive, as that's cheaper and cheaper. So we have to embrace this revolution. We have to have our own model. France is very proud to have Mistral AI. I hope that we'll have others, because, for example, there is a good model made from the French research, Bloom, and the Emirates, they did make Falcon, a pretty efficient model, starting from the French open source public research results. But then they did invest a lot of money to continue to train the model. And by the way, that's and maybe I finish with this to this question. As a, quite a veteran of digital revolution, again, I started 27 years ago, 29 years ago, 1995. I have more and more the feeling that this is a new revolution. We cannot face this revolution with a concept that did make us think about internet. That's something different. There is a need of GPU, as you know, of chips. There is a battle to control the production of chips. There is a battle to access to data. You need supercomputers. You need a very fast telecommunication system. This is a different battle. Internet was born as a digital common made by universities and academic people. This was born in the private sector, so the position of the government is not the same. We cannot just protect. We have to decide if we compete or if there is no need to compete. That's a different question. But my feeling, 1 year ago, I was quite anxious because I felt that we are converging to a small oligopoly of three companies. Today, I feel that there are a lot of open source models, a lot of data sets that, by the way, the big large language models, they don't find a business model because what can you build on a model that make that give you 90% of good answers and invent 10% of the answers with a completely crazy. So you cannot build a public service, you cannot build a tax system, you cannot build a security procedure. So more and more people are building smaller models to face smaller challenges, companion for lawyers, a companion for developers. And there is the beginning of an interesting diversity of approaches. So maybe we'll have to, because when France says that we want to be sovereign, we like this word in France, you will say probably more self-determination or autonomy, or that's the same idea. We don't want to control internet, we want to be free within internet. Basically, you have three ways to be sovereign. And the first one is the most simple, a real, diverse, and fair market. If there are enough offers, enough companies, if they are competing to give the best price, you are free. You have a choice, and you can negotiate. The second one is to be completely independent, but that's very expensive and slow. But sometimes, for some military procedures, for example, we prefer to build our planes ourselves, even the smaller piece, because we cannot rely on foreign countries. And I say very often that the third approach is to encourage a world with more digital commons, because I don't know if you realize, but today, the digital economies rely on free software, open standards, open data, Wikipedia, OpenStreetMap, Linux, MySQL, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, HTML. So this is not the market. That are resources that people made together to share it. And we, as Europeans, we should protect this, finance this, help those communities, work with them. So you have just three ways to be free. But a fair market is one way, and maybe the AI market will become a real diverse and competitive market. And if this, we don't have to make more. If this is not the case, probably as public, as states, we'll have to find to make like a CERN for AI, a huge public infrastructure with data, with computers, with free access for researchers, to not depend to three companies led by some crazy, autocratic, sometimes drug addict billionaires. We cannot build our future on three people like Elon Musk. That's impossible. Look what did happen in Ukraine when he decided to cut Starlink to change the course of the war. We cannot let this power to people, even if they are not drug addicts. I'm serious. We are responsible in front of our citizens. We are democracies. The people is supposed to be the sovereign. So that's all.
That's a brave ending.
Ambassador a lot to say this.
No, that's a brave ending remark.
Ja, Henri Verdier er en usædvanlig diplomat med sine egne skarpe holdninger. Og når man sidder der og lytter til ham på den store franske ambassade på Kongens Nytorv, sådan lige over for det gamle kongelige teater, og man er solidt plantet i 200 år gamle stole, man har en mundtlig debat ansigt til ansigt, og man sidder der mellem gamle gobeliner og malerier, ja, så kan man mærke den her franske, eller vi skulle måske sige europæiske kulturarv, der ligesom gobelinerne og malerierne lægger sig omkring en og dæmper lyden af det her digitale ekokammers historieløshed. Det, der er så fedt ved at være sammen med sådan en flok franskmænd, om jeg så må sige, det er, at de kan bare det der med at hive en fransk filosof op af hatten og komme op med en titel på en eller anden obskur bog, han har skrevet i starten af sin karriere, men som lige nailer det argument, de har gang i her, og så kan de så citere det og diskutere ud fra den og sidde og nikke lidt samtykkende alle sammen og sige, om den har jeg da også læst og så videre. Og man kan jo sige, at det er en meget eksklusiv elite af intellektuelle tænkere, som er skolet i, hvad skal man sige, den samme måde at tænke på og anskue verden på. Men det er også fascinerende, hvordan de kan være et boldværk mod det, man måske kan definere som den her amerikanske historieløshed, som man ofte støder på i Silicon Valley. Selvom man måske er glad for teknologien, så er der bare sådan en eller anden hul tomhed over nogle af de ting, der dukker op fra den kant. Så der var lidt at gå hjem og tænke over. Kunstig intelligens, generativ AI, super fedt værktøj, men hvad med alle de gamle filosofer og den europæiske kulturarv? Vi har et eller andet der, vi skal have til at spille sammen. Så hvis du har reaktioner på det, når du har lyttet her til podcasten, og jeg ved godt, den blev lidt lang, og jeg ved godt, at Henri Verdier, han taler med fransk accent, og han hopper lidt i argumentationen, men du er altid velkommen til at sende mig en e-mail på henriksnabla@tektopia.dk, og du kan også finde tidligere episoder på tektopia.dk, og vi kommer også til at beskæftige os mere med de her problemstillinger fremover, ikke mindst fordi der jo, som sagt, er valg både i EU og i USA. Du kan følge os på nogle af de udskilte sociale medier, dels i vores Facebook-gruppe Techtopia Backstage, hvor du kan mødes og diskutere med andre tech-interesserede. Og så er vi på X og Instagram, der hedder vi snabla@techtopia.dk, og du kan finde os på LinkedIn, og du kan abonnere på vores nyhedsbrev på techtopia.dk. Men frem for alt kan du abonnere på podcasten i din foretrukne podcast-app, hvilket jeg selvfølgelig håber, at du vil gøre. Jeg hedder Henrik Føns, jeg får hjælp til at producere Techtopia fra Veronica Wollin, og vi vil gerne se på genhør i næste uge. Techtopia. Techtopia er en ugentlig podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, støttet af .dk, IDA Forsikring og Messecenter Herning. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Techtopia.